This episode, I dare something completely new for the podcast. In the last episodes, we had examined the life and work of Archbishop Anna II, the city ruler of Cologne in the second half of the 11th century, one of the most notorious archbishops of the Cologne Middle Ages. This episode, I would like to take a more general look at this turbulent time, the second half of the 11th century. Which developments shaped this time, medieval Germany, and what to extent they affected Anno and also the city of Cologne. But all that would be far too complex for me. So I'm glad that Dirk from the History of the Germans podcast was kind enough to stop by for this episode. In our little chat, we start off by talking about our motivation, why we started our podcasts, and then go straight into the action, the second half of the 11th century. And I promise you one thing, Dirk's explanations are extremely valuable to better understand this period for Cologne. For example, you will learn why all these monasteries and churches are being built that we have covered so often in the episodes before, and why Anno really decided to kidnap young Henry IV in Kaiserswerth. Don't miss it, and most importantly, listen in on his show, the History of the Germans podcast. Let's get started right after the intro. Yeah, thank you very much, Dirk, for joining me here on this little chat we have about medieval Germany in the 11th century. Welcome to our little chat. Hi.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to come on to the history of Cologne. Great.
Yeah, as I told you, this is the first time I do such an interview like this. And oh, now you are getting even more pixel-like. But as long as we can hear each other, I think it will be fine.
Yeah, exactly. I think it records on both ends, so it'll be fine. Yeah.
Dirk, what was the goal of your podcast when you started, or what is your goal, or what's the passion behind it?
What's the passion? I mean, it's sort of, you know, so it all started, you know, with a dinner. So I had a dinner with a couple of friends. So I live in England, and I met these English people. We had dinner, and so somehow we ended up talking about history and about German history. And I realized, essentially, in England, there is a very detailed knowledge of the battles of the Second World War. There's a little bit of understanding of what happened in the run-up to the Nazi regime, but there is practically no information about anything before that. I mean, maybe 1871 to 1933 a little bit, but then it really peters out. And it's actually, you know, as I'm doing the podcast, I realize it's much worse than that. There is literally no English language stuff about the 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th century in Germany. It's astonishing. And I feel there's a huge gap. And it's, you know, history has always been a passion of mine. I've always been excited and interested in those. And I do like all these stories. And I felt there's just something missing here that, you know, that I think people might benefit, might enjoy. And it's also a nice way for me to sort of reconnect with my culture, with my background, given that I'm, you know, living abroad for a very long time now. And so it sort of started during lockdown, like probably a lot of other podcasts. And it's going fine. I think it's, you know, lots of people seem to like it. So I feel like it's worthwhile persisting. And I draw an enormous amount of enjoyment from it, you know, amongst other things, meeting people like you and other podcasters or academics in the field. Which is really, really enjoyable. And yeah, so I'm probably going to continue for a little while longer.
Great.
How about you? What made you do this?
The funny thing is, I know nobody will believe me, I planned this before lockdown. And I think I started in 2019 in July during a summer vacation. We had a horrible vacation apartment. I always want to say holiday, but it's a vacation apartment. Mm. And that's when I came up with the idea. But first of all, I thought I have to read like all of Cologne's ancient time, you know, like the Romans and starting all that. And then I thought, no, you have to have at least like 6 episodes about the history of Cologne for the podcast. And so I started producing those 6 episodes. When I published the first episode, I think it was at the end of January 2020, the lockdown came, and it looks like I'm just like everybody else who started a podcast during lockdown. My goals are pretty similar like yours. Cologne is a city that is, I don't think it's very famous, but not totally unknown. But if people think of Germany, outside of Germany, most of the people think of Oktoberfest in Munich or of the Reichstag building in Berlin, and of course of the Nazi time, which also is very much dominated by Berlin, Prussia, and all those funny little men that participated in it. And it sounds arrogant, but Cologne, in my opinion, is the only city in Germany, or maybe even across the Alps, that has been a big city continuously throughout 2,000 years and has such a rich history. And that is mostly unknown, even by Colonians. They always think Cologne is only football or American listeners, soccer, and Kölsch beer and carnival and nothing more. And it's much more. It's really, now I'm losing my train of thought, but
no. But I think it's a fascinating thing you're doing, because, you know, if you think about German history is not, you know, a straight line in the way that, you know, French history is, where 80% whatever happened in Paris, and, you know, or yeah. British history, where 80% that happened outside England, and a little bit that happened in England happened in London, and in Germany everything happened. You know, it's basically an agglomeration of lots and lots of histories. And the history of Cologne is probably one of the more interesting ones, because, you know, it goes back to the ancient Rome, has a huge importance in the Carolingian period, in the Ottonian period, and then throughout, you know, all the rest of history, you know, and, you know, all the way into, you know, Konrad Adenauer and the Bonn Republic. So, you know, I think you say you call it a microcosm of German or European history, and I think that is exactly what it is. You know, I sort of envy you to a degree, because at least, you know exactly what you're going to talk about at any given point in time. I know that, you know, by the time, you know, Konradin's getting beheaded in the market square in Naples in 1268, I'm out in the high seas. All sorts of stuff is going to happen, because the history will, you know, have fragmented so much that, you know, it's very difficult to contain the strain that leads you all the way to modernity. So I think you're doing a very smart move here.
Yeah. And one thing I also like about history, when I can literally touch it, and despite the destructions of World War II, it's amazing how much stuff is still there. Most of the time you can't see it, because post-war architecture consumes it, like a Roman watchtower that is in the middle of a big traffic junction and is used as a restroom by some people who are lazy
without
to find
entering on the inside.
Yes, and yeah, that's also what I love about the city of Cologne, that you can still walk around, touch a lot of things. Of course, many things have been rebuilt. All our Romanesque churches that are mostly 1,000 years old were destroyed in World War II, but they have been rebuilt. Most of them. One of it was not rebuilt, but that's another topic for another time. But as you said, the history of Germany is so defragmented in the long run, and in this little chat we want to do, we will find out why. And there's one step that leads to that defragmentation of history. So would you like to continue to that part?
Yeah, let's go and talk, because I think you want to talk about Anno.
So what is really coming short in my podcast so far, because I'm always talking about kings, emperors, bishops, and how the city looks like, is things that are on a larger level, like spiritual life, for example. It develops rapidly in Cologne in the early Middle Ages. We have a lot of monastery, parish churches, the old Cologne Cathedral is established. We have so-called Stifte. I don't know how you call them in your podcast, but like monastery in the light version. Yeah, I call them monastery in the light version. And those must have shaped, and I know they shaped, daily life in a big way. And it is assumed for Cologne that at least like 10% or 20% of the population in the High Middle Ages is working directly in those spiritual institutions. And of course, there are day laborers and servants also working there. So what are the developments here in the 11th century?
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, it's you know, as somebody living in the modern world, one of the most difficult things to understand, I think, about the medieval world is the importance of religiosity. Why does all this spiritual stuff play such an enormous role? I mean, you know, if you look at the resources that go into it in terms of, you know, the churches, the abbeys and so forth, that's where basically people spend their money. And if you, I think if you think about it, or the way that I try to explain it to myself is, the background of all medieval history from about 900 and something to, you know, the early 14th century is one of a perennial economic boom. You know, you have a massive growth in agricultural production. If you look at, you know, the time of Henry the Fowler, you probably get about 3 grains out of 1 grain seeded. So if you take your harvest, 1/3 of your harvest just is the seed for next year. By the time you get to the 14th century, you're looking at 1 to 8, 1 to 10, or even higher numbers. So you have a massive improvement in agricultural production. People have more to eat. And if you believe in things like the Maslow's pyramid of human needs, you start at the bottom. What you want is food, drink, shelter, you know, a little bit of belonging. But as you sort of grow up and, you know, more and more people come into a position where they can do what's called self-actualization. They can do the things that they want to do with their lives. You know, today people probably want to, whatever, sail across the Atlantic, do a lot of yoga, become podcasters. What they wanted to do in the Middle Ages was they wanted to go to heaven. That was the primary objective. And as more people move into a position economically where they can spend time and resources on that objective of going to heaven, you suddenly get developments where people say, well, you know, we want a priest. Now, in Cologne, that's not a problem. There's a priest on every street corner. But if you are in a village, you know, you probably need, you probably get a priest once a year coming around to say mass and, you know, do all the necessary baptisms and so forth. But so your first question is, I want a priest. Then you say, I want to have a good priest. I want to have a priest who's actually read the Bible, who understands the Bible and don't make all this stuff up. So he needs to be able to read and write. You know, and then you come to the next level, which is, you know, where the whole thing becomes quite theological and problematic, which is the question of, well, is the priest that's coming here, is he actually a valid priest? And one of the problems is what the church calls simony. So simony is the idea that you buy a church role. It comes back from the Bible, the sin of Simon, who was actually quite a decent guy. He just wanted to be a better preacher. So he asked Paul whether, you know, Paul could sell him the secret about how to do all the, you know, these miraculous baptisms he did. And Paul got really upset about it. But the fundamental problem for, you know, the person in the 11th century is the guy who's coming here calls himself the priest. You know, has he bought this position because, you know, he gave some money to the provost or the bishop? And then the question is the bishop actually the real bishop, or is he only become bishop? Did he only become bishop because, you know, he bought it from, you know, somebody else? So it's basically like you go to a Taylor Swift concert and you've bought a ticket. And you go there and you're not quite sure whether the ticket is the real ticket or whether it's the fake ticket. And the worst thing that happens is you come to the gate with your ticket and they tell you it's a fake and you have to quickly get another ticket for vast amounts of money or you might never see the concert. So people really cared about that. And it's not, you know, this is not coming from the top, from, you know, popes, bishops telling people to believe these things. This comes from the bottom up. So for me, the important starting point of all the, we call the investiture conflict is the Paternia uprising in Milan. So poor people, Paternia is basically, is torn clothes. So these are poor people who rise up and say, we want to have, we expect better from our archbishop and from the whole clergy that is in our city. And this uprising is a significant chunk in the story about the uprising, because the church is then sort of trying to co-opt this movement into their politics, because obviously Milan is an important city and the emperor has power there and the pope has power there and the archbishop has even more power there. So it matters. But the undercurrent of all this is that people want better from their clergy. And that goes all the way to, you know, goes to the Reformation. You know, it drives things like the Abbey of Cluny, it drives the Cistercians, it drives the Franciscans, and all these monastic orders, you know, they, you know, for 50, 100 years, they are, you know, proper priests and they, you know, they stick to the celibacy and so forth. And then too much money comes in and this discipline is a bit too painful. And then they all descend into debauchery. And then the next one comes up and the next type of monastic order tries to do the same thing and struggles. But I think it's important to understand this is one of the big drivers. And then the other two drivers are the papacy. You know, I think particularly when we talk about Anno, it's important to understand that he doesn't act purely out of his personal power interest, but also in the context of the role of the papacy and the drive towards a better quality of clergy. Because what's going on is by, if we go back to the Council of Sutri, that's about sort of 1043 or so, which is Henry III has goes to Rome, wants to get crowned emperor, and finds there are essentially three guys who claim to be pope. One is Gregory VI, who's bought the papacy, and this is the one case of genuine known simony, who bought the papacy from, I think, Benedict IX. Benedict IX has become pope because his uncle was pope, and he became pope. You know, a day before he was pope, he was a non-consecrated knight and an aristocratic thug in Rome. And then in the middle is some other dude who's also, has zero interest in pastoral care. These are all aristocratic Romans who used the papacy as part of their power play. So Henry III comes down and says, this is all nonsense, and deposes all three in one go and replaces them with his own bishops. I mean, the first two die very quickly, but Leo IX, his cousin, is the guy. Leo IX completely reforms the church, invent or creates the College of Cardinals, brings in people with genuine, you know, theological background, you know, St. Peter Damian, Humbert of Santa, Silva Candida. All these guys essentially start bringing the moral authority of the church back that has been completely lost. And for a long time, the emperor very much supports that project. You know, his job is, because there's this undercurrent of people who want better clergy, he puts himself at the forefront of that movement and says, look, you know, I've reorganized the papacy. I'm making sure, you know, that many of the monasteries are getting better run. I try to find you better archbishops. Anno is actually part of this, because Anno, as you say, quite eloquently explained in the podcast, is plucked from lower nobility and rises on meritocracy. He's a competent administrator, but also he's a competent theologian and a supporter of the reform program. So he brings these kinds of people in. That's what the people expect from the emperor. And when we get to, you know, towards sort of the coup of Kaiserswerth, the story before that is that I think it is 1059, but don't kill me if it's 1060. Or at some point, the Pope Nicholas II, I think, dies, and who's another reform pope. The reform minded cardinals elect another reform pope, and the archbishops and bishops of northern Italy find the whole reform thing a little bit tiresome because, you know, you're no longer allowed to have your wives and children running around Episcopal palace and all that. It's very irritating. And so they start to push for an anti-pope, Honorius III, or the I can't remember exactly his name. The problem now is that Agnes endorses the anti-pope. So now suddenly the empire, which was at before that at the forefront of that, you know, this movement that people wanted to improve the church, suddenly endorses the reactionaries, the counter-revolution, the guys who are on the wrong side. And for Anno, I think that is... That for me is the story of Anno's a coup in Kaiserswerth. You know, sure, he wanted to embellish and strengthen the Archbishopric of Cologne. But underneath this is also this whole story about, well, Agnes is essentially crashing the empire against the wall. We have an empire. The point of the emperor is almost as much a spiritual role as it is a temporal role. And so... by endorsing this, you know, anti-pope, the guy who doesn't not want to reform the church, she essentially diminishes that role, and ultimately, you know, it's a political conflict where Anno is, well, he's on the right side of history. You know, that's what, you know, the development over the next, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years is the rise of, you know, the papacy and the reform of the church. And she's trying to stand against it, and the reason she can do it is because she's the guardian and the regent of Henry IV. So Anno needs to get Henry IV in order to turn the policy around. The only problem is it doesn't work in the end for him.
Oh no, not at all.
Sorry, I've been talking nonstop now for 10 minutes. That wasn't quite the plan. Apologies.
A historian talking all the time, I can't relate to that, sorry.
Rarely ever happens. Yeah.
Those were really, really great additions to my Anno episodes, because what I tried at the end to explain is Anno is not the bad guy. He is always in Cologne, in the city of Cologne, always depicted as this evil dictator that was chased out by an uprising in the city and came back and then punished the people and, you know, blinded them and whipped them.
Which is interesting, because I always thought he was reasonably popular, because I think, I mean, Anno as a first name, the only place in Germany you find Annos in the first name is Cologne.
Oh, yeah. Well, interestingly, I don't know anyone who is called like that, but maybe it's older generations, like from my
yeah. Okay, it's not the most popular name anymore. But you know, if you look back in it, you know, I don't know. It's it just struck me that is one of the few names that, you know, that seem to be. If somebody's called Anno, I would automatically assume he's from Cologne.
Yeah. Well, other names of Cologne saints are quite popular still, like Severin.
Yeah, that's true.
But as I really try to say, is really Anno is not a really bad guy. He acts in the borders of his own mind and his beliefs of that time. And I think it's really interesting if you go to the neighboring town of Siegburg. Well, it's not really neighboring, but it's close, just 20 minutes of a car drive from Cologne. The picture is totally different. There he's in a new shrine that was made in 2021. They gave him now, in the 21st century, they gave him a new golden shrine with a really modern design. I really love it. I described it really quickly. His shrine is a little golden box in the middle that seems to float in a dark chamber of the monastery church in Siegburg. And around it is a house. And the house consists of letters of his biography. Oh, and it's really looks amazing. If you don't know that, Google that up after we done this recording. It's really, you don't have to be pious or not. I don't ask you that, but it's really, I think if you're pious or not, doesn't matter. It looks really amazing how modern religion can be displayed or maybe not. Well.
Yeah.
So I know this is a really broad question and you already got into that a little bit, like, you know, there's more grain available because of better production methods, but what is the general political, social, economic situation in the second half of the 11th century in the empire? Maybe just throw in some bits. You don't have to talk for 2 hours about that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can easily talk for a couple of hours on that. But I think what you see is, you know, as this boom progresses and more resources are available, essentially population grows dramatically, it allows for the emergence of more and more, you know, principalities, if you like. So if you look at, you know, the 10th century, you look at somebody like Margrave Gero, who acquires land that, you know, easily accommodates what will in the future be the Kingdom of Saxony, Brandenburg, most of Thuringia, blah blah. So, but you know, as we go into, you know, literally 100 years later, we already get into viable territorial entities that are much smaller in terms of size, but have roughly the same amount of resources. You then have we have the beginning of the great clearing of the forests. So when the Romans came to the Rhine, they took one look at it and said, this is all forest from here to basically, I mean, if they knew, probably to the tundra. You know, there is literally just one tree after another. You know, what you get around this time is the monasteries in particular, you know, get a plot of land, and then they start pulling down the trees and create agricultural land. So you have this growth of, you know, particular the monastic houses, but you also have cities starting to grow and communication lines to open up that been broken, you know, since Roman times. It's what you expect of an economic boom. I mean, it's not quite like China the last 40 years, not quite at that breakneck speed, but it is a significant increase in wealth, in city life, in road connections, in particular also water transport, which is important for Cologne. And so as that happens, you know, you get more particular interests. And what is the big shift in German politics or domestic German politics is, if you remember, the Ottonians came from Saxony, and Saxony is essentially geographically half of the empire. Not the richest half, but, you know, it's a very large landmass, and it is quite separate in its history, because it was actually only conquered by Charlemagne in the 8th century in a rather brutal war. They always had a feeling, you know, of being somewhat separate. And if you look at the elections, so the Ottonians, Otto 1, 2, 3, that's all fine. These are Saxons. The Saxons vote for them. That's fine. Henry II, who is an Ottonian, but he's been Duke of Bavaria and hasn't been to Saxony, they sort of, you know, they let the rest of Germany elect him, and then they elect him as well, because they do elect the emperor. And so there is a gradual, you know, shifting away of particularly the Saxons from the rest of Germany. But at the same time, the imperial, if you think about the empire, so as the emperor, you have rights all across the empire, and then you have your own lands and the things you have under direct control. And one of the most important bits of imperial control at the time was Goslar and everything around Goslar, because that's where the important silver mines were. And what you know happens particularly under Henry IV, but already under Henry III, is that the emperor is trying to territorialize that land. You know, Goslar, the Harz Mountains, you know, there's a famous castle, the Harzburg, that he built, which is an attempt to, you know, almost, you know, before the word, to have your Hausmacht, your home power as king, that you can draw on for money, for soldiers, etc., etc. Now, that encroaches on Saxony. You know, when we talk about Saxony today, it's not that area around Dresden. That's the Margraviate of Meissen that barely belongs to Saxony. What it is Niedersachsen, Westphalia, you know, and down to the Harz Mountain. The heart of the Saxon duchy is Werla, which is just outside Goslar. So as the emperor expands there, the Saxons get restless. They get ever more restless. There were conspiracies to murder Henry III amongst the Saxon nobles. There were conspiracies to kill Henry IV when he was a child by the Saxon nobles, because they felt this imperial overreach is basically going at the heart of us. There's a famous speech that Otto von Nordheim, who's the leader of the Saxons, in many ways, he's not the Duke of Saxony, but he's the richest and most powerful noble in Saxony, and he does a speech in 1074, so towards the end of Anno's life. But this is a current that goes into this, where he essentially says to the Saxons, "You've all sworn fealty to the emperor. We've all done that, but he's no longer our emperor. He's no longer working in our interest. He's moved away. He's gone over to the dark side. You know, he's Darth Vader now. You don't have to stick with his with him anymore. The oath is null and void," which is I think is a very important moment in German political history, because up until then the oath was the oath, and people really struggled and found it very difficult to walk away from these kinds of oaths and promises that they've made. As we go into the 1070s and later, first it's Otto von Nordheim says, you know, don't have to observe an oath to somebody who's not a decent emperor, and then the popes start to release people from their oaths. And by 1220, you know, people get excommunicated left, right, and center. Oaths being made, you know, and a day later they're broken. It's, you know, this whole medieval concept of personal relationships built on oath and trust and vassalage essentially collapses because nobody believes in oaths anymore. So that's the sort of, we are at the foothills of this development, but we are at the foothills, and that is also one of the, you know, I think key drivers of the world of Anno.
So oaths are just guidelines now.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what they are. Okay. I mean, it is ridiculous. I mean, there's... it's literally, you know, in the civil wars between Philip of Swabia and Otto the IV, these guys like the Landgraf of Thuringia and the Duke of Bavaria, they would swear to anything, you know, and then just weeks later, turn their soldiers around and fight the other side. It's not the ideal of chivalry that you've grown up with.
Henry the IV is pretty prominent in my podcast series because of the coup of Kaiserswerth, but then he's just a teenage boy and a young male, and he will come back to Cologne nearly 50 years later, or 40 years later, when Cologne expands its borders. You know, up until 1106, the city mainly remains in its Roman borders. They still used Roman city wall. They only extended a little bit to the east into the Rhine River and made the walls longer to the shoreline. But in 1106 or 1108, I don't know really well right now, at the moment, they expand their city in a big way. And they do that by inviting Henry IV as their king and emperor, while his son, Henry V, is already fighting against him. And they use that conflict to get the legitimacy to build that wall, even at the moment when the Archbishop of Cologne is still against that. So that is the time span I have. Henry IV as a young boy, and then as an old man close to the end of his life. So what happens between that? He nearly reigns over 50 years, but his reign was marked by severe crises, like, you know, pogroms in the cities against the Jewish population and the investiture controversy. I know big topics all, but maybe just short summary.
A short summary of one of the longest and most chaotic reigns in European history. Yeah, let's just give me 5 minutes and I'll do that. I think the important thing about the way Henry IV's reign developed is all around these sort of three things that I think I mentioned before. It's this sort of groundswell of people wanting a reform of the church. Then you have the fact that the church itself, you know, in particular the papacy, becomes much better at what it does, and it becomes much more self-assertive. So you have, you know, we talked about Leo IX and then Nicholas II, and now we're coming to Gregory VII. And the Gregory VII is the first sort of, if you like, power pope. So he cares as much about the temporal power of the papacy and the relationship between the papacy and the emperor as he does about topics of theology, or probably argue he cares much more about the first than about the second. So the papacy is developing this notion that, you know, you have the two swords. You have the temporal sword, so that's basically that's the sword of Christendom that fights the pagans with power, with military power, and you have the spiritual sword, which is held by the Pope or wielded by the Pope, who is the power of the word. And and Pope Gregory VII moves to the notion that the spiritual sword is superior to the temporal sword. Essentially, the emperor and the king has to obey them. Essentially, to kiss his feet. That's actually how he says it. And so Henry VI finds himself in that situation that the papacy is growing in stature and trying to assert itself as the more powerful. And he can, and one of the reasons essentially goes back to the coup of Kaiserswerth is when Agnes gave up the leadership of that reform project when she endorsed Honorius III, essentially the public opinion in Europe, to the extent it existed, sort of shifted towards believing, well, actually, we should look to the Pope to deliver on the promise of a better church, because the emperor or the empire is no longer doing it. And, you know, the aftermath of Cologne was that Anno went to the church council that essentially deposed Honorius III and established, you know, ended the schism. He thought he would lead that council, and he found himself within days to be relegated to the back benches. The front bench were St. Peter Damian, Humbert of Santa Salva Candida, the big cardinals, and Pope, can't remember, I think it might be Alexander II. I'm a bit hazy on popes. The ship sailed. So the emperor is no longer really leading that, but has to deal with a pope that is getting stronger. At the same time, we talked about the Saxon nobles who are going into outright rebellion. And so he gets squashed between these two trends. So And then we have this third event, which is this Paternia Rebellion in Milan, where the people rise up and want better quality clergy. The Pope tries to send an archbishop in as the better clergy, and the emperor sends an archbishop in as better clergy, which is a fantastic idea because these archbishops obviously start hitting out at each other. The whole thing escalates, and it ends up in a exchange of letters where famously Henry the Fourth writes a letter to the Pope Gregory the Seventh, whose Christian name is Hildebrand, and says to Hildebrand, "False monk, not pope," and ends with the word "step down, step down." Didn't work that well. The Pope responds essentially by excommunicating the emperor and deposing him, which is sort of, excommunication is something that happened before, but deposition, so deposing the emperor is some, or a ruling monarch, hasn't really happened before. That gives the rebels, in particular the Saxon rebels, the fuel to call an assembly, a royal assembly, which then basically says to Henry the Fourth, "Here it is, the Pope's deposed you. You've got a year and a day to get rid of that excommunication. If you haven't, we will elect a new king." This is why he has to go and then essentially intercept the Pope in Canossa and beg the Pope to excommunicate him. So he basically kneels in the snow for 3 days until Pope Gregory the Seventh, being still Pope and therefore a priest and therefore has to accept if somebody is a true repentant sinner. He was no repentant, and he was a sinner, but so we all.
Oh yes, we all are.
We all are indeed. There he founds himself, being released from his excommunication by the Pope, and rushes back to Germany. But the German prince is basically now off the reservation. Even though the Pope has essentially ended the excommunication and the deposition of their emperor, they still elect a new king, Rudolf von Rheinfelden. You then have civil war. Essentially, what you have is you have civil war from here on till Barbarossa, which is about 1152. And it's essentially the emperor against the princes. There's various versions of how they basically fight each other, but it is always that. Because the moment they elected this King Rudolf of Rheinfelden, they established the principle that the king of the Romans, as they call him, is essentially the ruler of the empire before he becomes crowned by the emperor, is a role that is handed out to the most deserving. So it's not a question of, you don't inherit the title, you get the title on merit. And the merit is established by an election process of, at this point, completely dubious structure. But there is no right to become emperor only because you've been the son of the previous emperor. And it's quite quickly becomes the established doctrine. Whereas in France, which also started out as an elective monarchy, the Capetians essentially consolidate into a inherited monarchy by around the same time. There's no question that if the king's dead, long live the king. In Germany, the king is dead, let's elect a new one. And so this is sort of Henry the Fourth's, story. It goes back and forth. Sometimes he finds, at some point he sacks Rome. It's he doesn't sack Rome. He gets somebody else to sack Rome, who is actually Gregory the Seventh's ally. So he comes down to Rome. He besieges the city. At some point, he gets into the city. Gregory the Seventh holds out in the Castello di Sant'Angelo, can't be get at. And then the Norman King of Sicily shows up to relieve Gregory the Seventh. When he arrives, his men are a little bit hungry and angry. So they sack Rome. So Gregory the Seventh's friends sack Rome. He has to leave Rome. He dies in Salerno. Everybody hates him. And he says, there I lie, you know, fighting for justice and the freedom of the church. And this is what I got for it. But, you know, this is a very brief moment where Henry IV is on the winning side. Most of the time, he gets blocked off by his princes, or you know, has to fight in Italy over Tuscany. Long story that I'll skip right now. But essentially, it's an endless civil war that then comes to an end when his son sides with the princes, because they can't. The son can't take it anymore. He just thinks this. You know, his father, getting increasingly irritated and more difficult to manage, is essentially destroying his inheritance. He needs to stop this. He needs to step up, get papal endorsement for his reign, bring the whole thing to some sort of stabilization. And that's essentially what happened. So, you know, he captures his father. His father still, I'm not sure whether I get this right, whether it was before or after, but definitely after still. So his father escapes from prison that his son has put him in and goes to Cologne. And essentially the city of Cologne becomes the great ally of Henry IV, who, and there's a siege, but in the end, you know, Henry IV ultimately dies and Henry V takes over. And at that point, you get a little bit of stabilization. So there's the Concordat of Worms, where there's some sort of agreement between the Pope and the Emperor about the future of the church and how to manage the church, which gives us a bit of a breather before the Civil War kicks off again after Henry V's death, because he left no heirs. But Henry IV's reign is the great turning point of the Middle Ages, because it established all the things that you know, that is the Holy Roman Empire afterwards, which is you know, a weak emperor, an elective monarchy, a drifting away of the north. You know, if you do the history of the sort of the 12th, the 13th century, you suddenly find yourself essentially writing the history of southern Germany and Italy. And the north of it, you know, what happens in Brandenburg, what happens on, you know, the eastern border, you know, the growth of the Teutonic Knights, all that essentially happens in a non-imperial world. You know, the power of the emperors ends on the Main River. And and all these trends, I think are quite significant, and they start around the reign of Henry IV. And they, you know, essentially, yeah, they kick off with the coup of Kaiserswerth and, you know, contain an awful lot of steps in between in these 50 years that leave us with a sort of very different world afterwards. And if I was a 19th century historian, I would say this is a diabolical outcome, because Germany didn't become a state until 1871 because of all the things that happened at that time. And it's all the fault of the Pope and, you know, it's the Catholics, obviously, who ruined the country. I think we are today a little bit more relaxed. Well, actually, I think if it's always, you know, hindsight is always a weird thing, but it is also the time where this federal structure of Germany is essentially established, you know, so that, you know, the different cities, the different states go their own ways. You have a lot of centers in Germany. You know, history happens, you know, I think we said in the beginning, you know, in Paris, 80% of French history happens in Paris. There's no place in Germany you can say where more than 20% of history has happened. You know, it's all over the place. Where you know, important events took place, and also where today, you know, you Cologne is an important center. So is Hamburg. So is Munich. So is Frankfurt. In a way that, you know, maybe in Italy you have a sort of similar structure, but in a state like France or the UK, you just don't have such important centers you know, that drive the history of the country, or that you know, that where people coalesce and where events take place. So Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's a very, it's a massively crucial moment in history, and, you know, it kicks off in Cologne. Like all the important events all start in Cologne.
Well, Clovis, the first Merovingian, was crowned right outside Cologne as the king of all the Franks, just saying. Okay. Yeah. Not in Paris or Rheims. I cannot pronounce French words. Rheims, R-E-E-M-S.
Rheims or Laon. I mean, Laon was actually the capital, so it would have been... Well, I can't remember what Clovis's capital was. It's probably Amiens.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
I forgot as well.
But I think, I mean, for all these, you know, it's very nice to talk about capitals, but basically these are just staging posts. You bring your 1,000 retainers over there. They've eaten all and everything within, you know, 4 weeks, and you have to move.
Yeah, exactly. Because you can't feed them. Such a large group, you can't feed them at that time.
Yeah.
And according to, speaking about 19th century historians, they also hated many of the Ottonians as well because they were too Italian.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's the fateful entanglement in Italy.
Yes.
Yeah.
But thank you very much. I think with that, we really have the arch between, you know, the coup of Kaiserswerth and when Cologne expands its city wall at the beginning of the 12th century. So thank you very much for that and putting it in just a few minutes.
Well, I think a slightly overdone the, you know, do it in 5 minutes thing. It's not quite, we didn't quite get there.
That was our chat about Germany in the 11th century. Many, many thanks to you, Dirk, for taking the time to share your knowledge with me. I hope to return the favor, and then I will tell you everything about 13th century Cologne that I know of. Be sure to listen on Dirk's podcast, History of the Germans. He's currently, at the time of this recording in November 2022, already in the 13th century and covers the Hohenstaufen dynasty. A thoroughly exciting era, also for Cologne. I'm looking forward to getting there myself. You can find the link to History of the Germans in the show notes or just visit historyofthegermans.com. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks again, Dirk, for stopping by. Rate this podcast where you can. It is the easiest and most importantly free way to support this podcast. Feel free to follow me on my social media channels. You can find all that and more in the show notes for this episode. Keep well. And auf Wiedersehen.